the SEALs were redeployed. In keeping with the sensitive nature of the operations, John never told Val where he'd been or what he'd done. When John returned home to his family, he'd arrived at a decision. The window for getting on operations and gaining combat experience was closing. It was time to spend more time at home with his girls. He didn't want to hold out for another opportunity to get into combat. The only missions on the horizon appeared to be more of the same, and while exciting at times, they were more of a letdown than a validation. He left Red Team behind and joined the 2-4's survey team. Survey, as it was simply known, focused on the comprehensive surveys of locations the 2-4's customers, Delta and other units or organizations, valued around the world. In Survey, John built on the basic airfield and drop zone survey skills common to all combat controllers, adding AutoCAD computer drafting to his expertise. John found he liked the work as much as he appreciated the more predictable schedule for his blossoming family. Though not high octane like being on Red Team, the survey team had its share of intense situations, placing men, often working alone, in precarious situations around the globe. Meanwhile, Madison was growing fast, Brianna hot on her heels, as the family entered the new millennium. John, now well settled into the drafting and computer skills of his survey job, came home in the evenings to little ones awaiting his nightly entry. Inside, and much to Val's dismay, he often grabbed the girls up, bundled inside a blanket, and would toss them into the air, brushing the ceiling to catch them again, then toss them, tiny arms flailing, onto the couch. By September of 2001, the couple had devised a plan. While John's new computer and survey skills sharpened, his core counterterrorist skills and proficiency dulled as he made peace with the fact that there'd be no war to validate his military career. He contemplated the future after combat control. John and Val had agreed he was only going to do 20 years, then use his drafting and survey skills to increase his salary in preparation for the girls' later schooling. They were already attending a costly private academy, supported by the income from Val's in-home nursing career, and the proud parents intended to continue providing the best academic preparation. Secretly, though, John harbored a dream of opening his own custom auto shop, where he could create and wrench vehicles like the Cobra kit car he was building in his spare time. On the night of September 10th, he stood in his garage with a beer, looking at the project, and wondering when he might finally get the time to finish the vehicle, still barely a frame, with an engine, drivetrain, and various parts scattered across his workbench and garage. The world was peaceful. His relationship with Val was strong. His girls were growing. And he accepted a future that didn't involve proving himself in combat as he'd once hoped. As things stood, John was just fine with that. Chapter 5. September 11th, 2001. The 23rd STS, the same unit that augmented the 2-4 for the Panama invasion, sits on the far side of Hurlburt Field's runway, across from Headquarters Air Force Special Operations Command, AFSOC. The base, itself home of the majority of AFSOC's forces, is actually an auxiliary field of the giant Eglin Air Force Base and test range, thereby reducing Hurlburt's status from base to field. Older maps identify it as Auxiliary Field Number 9, and show only a smattering of buildings, not the sprawling amoeba of compounds it is today. At the time of the founding of the original air commandos for use in Laos and Vietnam, it was the perfect location, tucked anonymously away in the swamps of the Florida Panhandle, hidden from prying eyes. The famous 1970 Santé POW rescue attempt was planned and rehearsed there for that very reason. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, the 23rd was planning to hold a squadron-wide Monster Mash physical endurance training event consisting of a series of unusual physical challenges in which teams competed against one another. Pedaling his bike from home to the Monster Mash that clear summer morning was Calvin Markham, a 16-year Master Sergeant and CCT. Despite putting himself at an energy deficit disadvantage, Monster Mashes could go on as long as half a day, leaving participants depleted for several days, depending on which group of combat controllers planned them. He regularly rode in to work, regardless of the day's schedule. A giant of a man with round features and a burly but friendly personality to match, Calvin kept a closely cropped haircut to de-emphasize a high hairline. Parking his bike near the entrance to the unit's team rooms, he walked in to jarring images blaring from the television in the corner. The first twin tower of the World Trade Center in New York City was heavily damaged, smoke billowing out in waves from the initial plane strike. By the time the second plane struck, the men of the 23rd were already packing. Precision microwave airfield landing systems, combat search and rescue gear, radios, laser markers, and weapons. They knew what was coming. 3 weeks later, Calvin and a fellow CCT, along with a special tactics officer, were running an airfield called Karshi Khanabad, known to all as K2 in Uzbekistan, where the U.S. would begin staging a preparation for its first operations in Afghanistan. The three men were literally first there in establishing and operating the airbase for the U.S. By the first week of October, the 5th Special Forces Group had planned to insert two operational detachment alphas, ODAs, or A-teams, as the first teams to link up with the Allies' newest partners, the loosely organized and fractious Northern Alliance. In actuality, several groups of differing tribes and leaders, some of whom would rather fight each other for local dominance than the Taliban. The two ODAs, each made up of in between 10 and 12 Green Berets with different specialties, such as weapons, communications, or medicine, were numbered 595 and 555, the latter known by the moniker Triple Nickel. The first would strike out for Mazar-e-Sharif, the other for Bagram Airfield, the abandoned Soviet airbase just north of the capital, Kabul, in the hope that it could be secured and readied for when U.S. operations moved within Afghanistan's borders. Each ODA was commanded by an army captain and seconded by a chief warrant officer. Their missions were to establish contact with the Northern Alliance, determine the battlefield dynamics, and crucially, employ air power to destroy the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in northern Afghanistan. The two ODAs were responsible for separate locations and took radically different approaches in their planning and execution, which would have significant consequences in the coming weeks. Both ODAs were offered CCT to coordinate and apply air power. ODA 595 rebuffed the offer. In the words of combat controller Bart Decker, they didn't want anything to do with CCT. ODA 595's decision to exclude CCT would provide the definitive case study, showcasing the difference between forces that had a controller and those that did not. Footnote. The first two ODAs to enter Afghanistan went in the same night, but their initial effects through air power could not have been more divergent. ODA 555, with Calvin Markham, put bombs on target beginning with his first strike, as outlined in this chapter. ODA 595, the team featured in the Hollywood movie 12 Strong, electing to go without a CCT, was so unsuccessful in airstrikes that the 5th Special Forces Group Commander, Colonel John Mulholland, directed a CCT, Matt Leinhard, along with the Tactical Air Control Party, TACP, to be attached to them even though they were already in the field. According to Bart Decker, one of the horse soldiers in Doug Stanton's book of the same name and the man in the most circulated photo of their exploits, recalls, they were yard-sailing bombs all over the place. From his location with their field commander, Major Mark Mitchell, he helped coordinate Leinhardt's insertion, recognizing that 595 needed the controller if they were to succeed and not kill friendlies. Major Mitchell was a smart commander and a great guy, recalls Decker. On October 22nd, the two air power experts joined ODA 595. It was not an easy assignment. Toughest job in the world is to try and integrate into an ODA that doesn't want you, adds Decker. But Linehard and the TACP performed flawlessly, dividing themselves into separate 595 elements and calling numerous danger close airstrikes with surgical precision. ODA 555, familiar with the expertise of combat control, recognized not only the value of a controller, but its necessity if they were to be successful in their third mission tasking. Green Berets are experts in aligning with, training, and fighting alongside indigenous forces with a proud legacy founded in Southeast Asia. And while authorized to call in airstrikes, as indeed any soldier or sailor on the battlefield can, they were by no means experts or even proficient. ODA 555 was provided a list of available CCT and discussed the names internally. One name stood out, Calvin Markham. Calvin and one of his sergeants, Greg McCormick, had gone through the Special Forces Combat Diver course together as swim buddies and had remained in contact over the years. McCormick identified the controller as the guy, and the matter was settled. By the end of the first week of October, Calvin had moved into isolation with the team and began his own planning. ODA 555 was commanded by a captain, although the one actually in charge was the chief warrant officer, the most senior and experienced man on the team, David Diaz. Calvin had great respect for Diaz, stating, "He'd been in Afghanistan in the 80s, and he knew how the people thought. He was a great leader and was respected by all the guys." Calvin's air plan, however, was hardly solid, which was a source of concern for the controller. In the early days of the war, there were no Air Force Air Operations strike planning cells. Instead, a few controllers from the 23rd, the first Special Tactics Squadron to arrive in country, along with a handful of pilots and air planners, built the strike plan from scratch. Bart Decker and the others did their best to coordinate for the unknowns. Decker described it as merely CAS, close air support, on call. There were no procedures. No one knew what was going to happen. On October 19th, Calvin and ODA 555 were about to find out. After two attempts at clearing the 20,000-foot peaks of the Hindu Kush range in the midst of severe weather, the joint team finally skimmed the snow-covered terrain and passed into Afghanistan. His immediate boss, Special Tactics Officer Kurt Buller, had walked Calvin to the helicopter, telling him, "You're the first," adding, "I don't know if I envy you or I'm sending you to your death. This could very well be a suicide mission." Buller stayed on the helicopter as it taxied to ensure there were no problems with the helo's movement, climbing off just before takeoff. The two men shook hands as Buller wished him happy hunting. Because of the altitude, the men were piled into two separate Special Operations MH-47s that had been stripped of all armor and flew with the minimum fuel required to insert the team across the border. At their designated HLZs, both helos were offloaded without incident or enemy contact. Then, they left the men behind to pursue their perilous missions. Calvin's team was met by a group from the Northern Alliance shortly thereafter and began the critical task of establishing mutual trust over tea and raisins offered by the Afghans. The entire group of several dozen mounted a convoy of old trucks and SUVs and headed into the Panjshir Valley. Even though the Taliban often attacked local villages, Calvin and the team made no enemy contact for the first 2 days. Instead, they focused their efforts on winning over the Northern Alliance leader, General Mohammad Qasim Fahim, a man whose distrust of the Americans and their reasons for being in his country ran deep. but there was one foolproof way they could demonstrate their commitment and value. Air power. Calvin recalls, "They were pretty skeptical of us. They'd been promised air before." The Afghan leaders had yet to see any of this mysteriously magical war-changing promise. Calvin's chance to represent the entire might and commitment of the U.S. came on October 21st, a bright and cold morning when Chief Diaz sent a reconnaissance, recce team, to find the Northern Alliance front line. It was believed to be near the airfield at Bagram and under the command of an Afghan leader named Baba John, whose girth led to the natural Americanization of General Papa John. The men clambered aboard a few trucks and drove south. As the small recce team moved onto the north end of Bagram Airfield, the front turned out to be the airfield itself. They dismounted the vehicles and proceeded on foot. The Northern Alliance owned the former Soviet airbase only from midfield north. The Taliban held everything to the south. This World War I-style stalemate had existed for years, despite fierce attempts by each party to dislodge the other. If Calvin could deliver airstrikes on the entrenched Taliban positions, he could single-handedly change the course of the stalemate, perhaps the war. As they moved cautiously across the flat terrain, dotted with leafless trees, preparing for the coming winter, Diaz told Calvin, "Get where you can establish a good OP, observation post. Hide in plain sight." They crept close to the Taliban, and Calvin's observation post materialized before his eyes, the air traffic control tower. Who would expect the Americans to climb into the most obvious building on the airfield? Perfect. The men cautiously approached the structure and then cleared its rooms to ensure no Al-Qaeda forces were waiting inside. By then it was late morning, the warmth of the sun a welcome respite from the cold. As Calvin and the team surveyed the airfield through binoculars and a spotting scope, he set about preparing the tools of the combat control trade. First were the Soflam laser target designator and range finder. Then he erected his SATCOM antenna and checked his communications link with the nascent Joint Special Operations Air Component. The JSOAC would be his source for air when he needed it. After he'd checked in, the controller next began identifying targets he might be able to strike. With enemy lines blurred and only a few hundred meters from his location, the potential for fratricide was significant. The one thing he couldn't do, kill men from his own side. And apart from the few Green Berets with him, and their CIA interpreter, the only member of Triple Five who could communicate with the locals, he didn't know any of the friendlies or how to tell them apart from the Taliban. Everyone looked the same through binoculars or the spotting scope. A short time later, the JSOAC called Calvin. "You've been approved for aircraft. Your first flight will arrive on station at noon." He checked his watch. Less than an hour. Shit. Calvin hadn't even requested air yet, and now two FA-18s launched from the USS Theodore Roosevelt were already inbound, sprinting the 700 miles from the aircraft carrier's location in the North Arabian Sea. They were flown by two pilots anxious to get close-range kills directed by someone on the ground. Calvin set one Green Beret on the Soflam to designate targets, while the other manned his SATCOM radio. Calvin got on his primary strike radio. He carried two, and as usual, his CCT ruck weighed more than anyone else's on the mission. He was ready. The tension in the air traffic control tower was building. Everyone sensed something big was about to happen. Except Papa John. Recalls Calvin, "He was pretty skeptical. Thought we were just there for show." Then, the first aircraft arrived. Diaz had the target in the crosshairs of their spotting scope and asked Calvin, "Is that the target?" Taking the handset from his ear and looking through the scope, he confirmed, "That's it." Then he cleared the aircraft. Hot. 30 seconds, he told everyone in the tower. The heavy-set general bent forward and looked through the offered scope, but not before giving everyone in the room a final doubtful look. Seconds after he put his eye to the scope, the bunker Calvin had ID'd for his first target disappeared in a direct hit from 2 500-pound bombs. The tower shook, and General Papa John stood upright to look out the windows, which had long since been shot out of the tower cab, as if the spotting scope was playing tricks on him. Before him, the former Taliban headquarters bunker was a blackened, smoking heap of earth and rubble, the smoke of the bombs still rising in the air. Calvin had no time to enjoy the view. His next planes, F-14s, also from the Roosevelt, were already checking in. Behind them, the 1st Air Force Hunters, F-15 Strike Eagles and F-16 Falcons, were chomping at the bit, no doubt wishing their Navy brothers would clear out of the airspace. The men in the tower watched the battle tone change across the airfield. Taliban positions were frantic. The CIA interpreter, now on the Taliban's frequency, passed himself off as one of their own, asking about damage. The response was immediate and alarmed. Their frontline leader had been killed. In the very first airstrike in the struggle for the Afghan capital, Calvin Markham, with the help of his team, had just killed the most important man in the battle. Papa John was elated at the prospect of so many dead Taliban and the ease with which it had happened. Calvin cleared hot each plane in order, striking Taliban positions to within 300 meters of their location, causing the men in the tower to take cover behind the flimsy walls of Soviet-quality construction as shrapnel and shock waves rocked the top floor. Not a single friendly fighter was injured during Calvin's first strikes of the war. In a handful of strikes, these few Americans, led by the skill of one unique individual, broke a 3-year Taliban stranglehold on the airfield. Papa John and the other leaders of the Northern Alliance were no longer skeptics. Calvin recalls, "The CIA guys couldn't get the CAS on target. When I got bombs on that first day, hitting C2, command and control, and rocket sites, our credibility was immediate. And Calvin and the Triple Nickel were just warming up." Their next mission was an 18-by-37-mile target area in the Panjshir Valley. But a handful of fighter aircraft diverted at the last minute were not going to be enough to displace thousands of well-armed and armored Taliban. Calvin needed more air, and lots of it. To strike an entire valley, he needed bombers. But he'd also have to be close enough to differentiate friend from foe and adjust fire. Calvin and the Triple Nickel needed to be among the Northern Alliance fighters. After pleading with the Jesowak for more air for a week, he finally got his wish. ODA 555 established 3 observation posts in the valley, and on October 28th, 9 days after arriving in Afghanistan, Calvin received multiple B-1s and B-52s, fully laden with hundreds of 1,000 and 2,000-pound bombs. Footnote: a B-52 can carry as many as 51 500-pound bombs and 30 1,000-pounders distributed inside its cavernous bomb bay and slung from its wings. A B-1's payload, all of it internal, is 5,000 pounds more than the venerable 1950s-era B-52s, but it enjoys a sleeker design and a reputation for speed of delivery. "Throughout the first week of November, we broke the back of the Taliban," recalls Calvin. "So many bombing runs took place nonstop that he began coordinating them to hit while he slept. He knew the valley better than any training range he'd called air onto back in the States and began to share the cleared hot burden with his teammates, who by then were becoming proficient in the art themselves." By this time, the men of 555 and the Northern Alliance shared a strong bond, sleeping in the same locations, sharing both the MRE rations of the Americans and the local Afghan food, including slaughtered goats and sheep. Calvin would call in resupply drops, normally delivered by C-130s, to keep the team in ammunition, food, and other necessities, the most critical being batteries for his radios and targeting equipment. Unfortunately, it didn't always work out well for Calvin and 555. This dumbshit colonel in Germany who was in charge of rigging our resupply didn't want to use her precious and expensive chutes. Instead, she sent disposable high-speed versions which blew up on opening at the high altitudes. They burned in, sometimes costing us our entire resupply. The men in America's first major conflict since the Gulf War, it seemed, were not immune to the vagaries of the military's logisticians and bean counters. With no showers for more than 2 weeks, they'd begun to take on a most Northern Alliance ambiance as well, but that didn't make them Afghans. The white Americans, using Northern Alliance vehicles to move about the country, were now being targeted by a reeling Taliban. To combat the possibility of assassination or ambush, Diaz began masking their intentions by coordinating vehicles for a certain destination and then changing it through their interpreter once they were rolling. But it would only be a matter of time before the Taliban countered the tactic and struck the men at one of their various camps. The potential problem was solved by the Northern Alliance leaders, who were gaining confidence with each successful airstrike and were pushing to take Kabul. On November 11th, 555 was told the Afghan force was moving on the capital. The Triple Nickel wasn't prepared for, nor tasked with, such an audacious mission. But in the end, there could be only one course of action. If the Afghans moved, they would too. Higher, HQ, was so worried about us going into Kabul, but we really didn't have a choice. We were in Northern Alliance trucks, so where they went, we went, recalls Markham. They weren't, in fact, the first Americans to approach Kabul. The CIA's Jawbreaker team, its first on the ground, was already on the edge of the capital, and also armed with a 2-4 CCT. But the Triple Nickel was the first to bring air power. Calvin realized his requirements were going to be immense, and his faith in the sluggish Jesowak request system, never strong, was diminishing. It was a bit comical. Someone thousands of miles away with no idea of the situation on the ground was deciding how much air I needed or would get. As with the Northern Alliance's push, he had little choice but to request everything they had, especially bombers, in the hope that Jesowak would grasp the gravity of a full-on assault on the Taliban and give him what he needed. An all-out battle was at hand, two sides facing off with all available men and weapons. It was like Braveheart, with both sides lined up, as the battle formed, recalls Calvin. The two armies, no more than 500 meters apart, prepped weapons, passed orders or encouragement for their men, and waited. Going into deliberate battle for the first time, 555 discarded their CIA-provided Afghan clothing and donned uniforms. They would not go into battle as anything but Americans. Calvin and a couple of 555 soldiers occupied a 2-story building, repeating their Bagram strategy and readied the controller's equipment. Nearby in another building, Diaz established a sniper's hide to provide protection for his men and the combat controller, enabling them to focus on turning the battle. The Taliban, with no idea the ODA was there, were completely oblivious to the amount of destructive power inbound against them. At 0800, the morning after 555's arrival in Kabul, the Taliban opened fire on the Northern Alliance. In the hope of routing them, the Taliban fired everything they had prepped. The exchange of fire was stunning. I'd never seen fire anything like it in my life, remembers the combat controller. The exchange went on for hours. Meanwhile, Calvin and his teammates were already calling in strikes as fast as they could. The aircraft arrived in droves, forcing the controller to start stacking them in air traffic holding patterns at different altitudes, just as Bruce Barry had done a decade earlier in the remote desert of Iraq. Only this time, there was an entire battlefield surrounding the CCT, and the fates of thousands of men, friend and enemy alike, were in his hands. At an insane pace, he scribbled call signs, payloads, and playtimes, the time a particular aircraft was available to remain on station. Bombers, fighters, Navy, Air Force, Coalition, they kept coming as word of the significance of the battle spread. This forced the combat controller to employ innovative sequencing and use of aircraft. I was putting B-52s in timed strike patterns. When they rolled in, my fighters were out, and they could drop their bombs from 30,000 feet. Once those bombs hit, my fighters were rolling in and putting bombs right on. It was like the B-52 was marking the target for them, he recalls in an interview. After 2 hours of the most intense airstrikes of Calvin's life, the battle was still not turning in the Northern Alliance's favor. The Taliban, with superior numbers of men and equipment, now rolled on the friendlies with Soviet tanks and heavy anti-aircraft weapons, aimed like rifles at Allied positions, including the fire control building occupied by the controller and his team. To protect the most valuable man on the battlefield, Northern Alliance troops were instructed to defend the American position. The battle was raging with hand-to-hand fighting at the base of the building, and Diaz's overwatch was insufficient to hold the enemy at bay. By the time of the airfield battle, whenever we were under threat, their mission was to keep us alive at all costs, Calvin recalls of their Afghan security force. While he continued focusing all his attention on receiving targets from his Green Beret spotters and laying down bomb strikes, below him, Northern Alliance soldiers were laying down their lives to protect his. 18 years after the battle, these nameless men remain close to his heart, their sacrifice not forgotten by the man whose job it was to liberate their comrades. There's no greater respect in the world than someone who's willing to lay down their life for you in combat. Of the men who died for him, he states simply, "They weren't the best equipped or trained, but they were men. I'll never forget them, or the honorable way they died." Despite the Afghan protection that allowed him to continue bringing air power to bear, the tide was turning against the Northern Alliance. Thousands were already dead on both sides, but the Taliban's superior numbers were proving decisive. The Northern Alliance, including Triple Five, for whom there would be no retreat without their selfless Afghan brothers in arms, was in danger of being overrun. Calvin could still see 2,000 Taliban troops, supported by armored personnel carriers in addition to the tanks, staged for a final and massive push. Behind them, a second wave waited. He needed to take a game-changing gamble. Overhead, he had another B-52 poised to strike, but this one was different. It was loaded with 27 2,000-pound bombs, which he intended to place within 500 meters of his own position from 30,000 feet. Unfortunately, none of the bombs were precision-guided, but were merely dumb bombs, subject to winds and atmospheric disruptions through 6 miles of airspace without correction. Such a mission at home on the training ranges of Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, required a 5-mile safety standoff distance. With such a massive single delivery, if he was off with any of his multiple calculations, the coordinates, his position, the friendly locations, all derived from an inadequate and antiquated Soviet map, not only would the Northern Alliance lose the battle for Kabul, but he and the rest of his team would be vaporized by his own hand. The combat controller looked to his teammates. They looked back, poised behind their weapons and the targeting equipment, as a battle for survival was being waged one floor below them and across the fields to their front. Men were fighting and dying. The Americans stared for what felt like an hour, but in reality was merely seconds, while everyone weighed the consequences. He asked his team, "Are you guys good with this? Are we going to do this?" To a man, all agreed. He rechecked that his SST-181 radar beacon, the only device he had to mark their position for the bomber, was working, checked the strike coordinates a final time, and called in the airstrike. After inputting the data at 30,000 feet, his aircraft, traveling at nearly 500 miles per hour toward the men's fate below, the pilot asked the controller to confirm he wanted the strike placed immediately adjacent to their own position. "I told him that if we didn't, we were going to be dead anyway." Despite the desperation on the ground, the controller waved the pilot off his first pass and sent the bomber around again, using the time to reconfirm every decimal. When the plane reported inbound the second time, Calvin, gazing out upon the surreal scene before him, almost Hollywood in its drama, took another breath, keyed his black plastic handset, and stated clearly and calmly, "Cleared hot." Seconds later came the pilot's reply, "Bombs away." Bombs released at 30,000 feet take roughly 1 minute to fall to Earth. Outside the strike building, thousands of warriors, committed to their opposing causes, continued to fight, oblivious to the gravity-delivered destruction headed their way. Through the Alliance lines, 555 sent the word, "Get down!" Committed to a destiny of his own devising, Calvin looked up at the clear blue sky, so deceptively serene, and at the B-52 high overhead as it left four contrails from its 8 turbofan jet engines, and thought of his family back home. He took a deep breath and hugged himself to the floor. The strike was perfect. 54,000 pounds of explosive death detonated parallel to the remnants of the friendly line directly in front of them. Black smoke blossoms of dirt and fire stretched out over a mile-long line, exploded into the air. Then the sound hit, concussion after concussion, rocking everyone on the battlefield, stealing the breath from their lungs. Calvin's building buckled but stood. In slow motion, heavy pieces of armored carriers and tanks tumbled through the air, their landings silent as they were drowned out by the deafening roar of 2,000-pound bombs releasing their energy at an atomic 25,000 feet per second in every direction. In the immediate silence that followed, itself strangely deafening, the line of huge craters, bordered by pieces of men and rifles and the hulks of armored equipment, revealed themselves to the stunned Taliban and Northern Alliance witnesses. Beyond the destruction, the Taliban's second wave could be seen racing south in retreat. The road to central Kabul was suddenly open, and within an hour of his battle-ending airstrike, Calvin and 555 were again in the back of Northern Alliance vehicles, riding into the city in a scene reminiscent of a liberated French town from the Second World War. Pockets of resistance remained, but the capital fell, and Calvin Markham arrived in the city at 0800 on November 13th. It was his 26th day of combat. What Pentagon planners believed would take more than 6 months was accomplished in less than a month by the commitment of a sometimes fractious Northern Alliance and one Special Forces ODA with a lone combat controller. During the handful of days immediately following the insertion of ODA 555 and the other A-teams with CCT, the Northern Alliance's control of the country went from less than 15% to 50%. In his Silver Star citation, Calvin Markham, the first combat controller to direct airstrikes in America's response to 9/11, is credited with directing dozens of airstrikes involving over 175 sorties of both strategic, heavy bombers, and attack aircraft, resulting in the elimination of approximately 450 enemy vehicles and over 3,500 enemy troops. This led to the eventual surrender of hundreds of Al-Qaeda and Taliban ground forces during his first mission, lasting 42 dangerous and often desperate days. They would not be his last days of danger. After the big battle, among the rubble of the formerly besieged Afghan capital, two friends met, CCT from different squadrons. They were dirty and disheveled, both having gone nearly a month without bathing. Their clothes were stiff with crusted sweat and dried mud, and their beards and hair were grungy as they hugged each other in brotherly fashion. Calvin was wrapping up his first mission. The other, a man named Joe O'Keefe, was a 2-4 operator and member of its Advanced Force Operations team. Joe was the CIA's Jawbreaker combat controller. Like Calvin, he'd snuck into the country weeks before, but with a 4-man agency team. Calvin, having just delivered victory in the first major battle of the war, but with severe frustrations over the way commanders and planners in the rear delivered everything from batteries to bombs, shared his experiences. "We brainstormed. How can we do this better?" says the burly CCT. As much as they were fighting the enemy, they were also fighting an Air Force bureaucracy, coordinating its air support through a rigid process stretching back to the 1970s of Laos and Vietnam. "There was no procedure for what we were doing. We were writing the books," he recalls. Stateside, John Chapman wasn't writing the book on new airstrike procedures. He was trapped in the survey shop, writing survey assessments and generating products for others to use in contingencies or war. And, as in the Gulf War, he found himself sidelined. Only this time, it was by choice. He'd chosen to move to surveys, and now the newest war, striking the United States from a clear blue sky 2 months before, had the entire focus of the U.S. military, except himself, it seemed. In Bagram, Joe O'Keefe and Calvin Markham went their separate ways, knowing they were at the beginning of a long war with a bureaucracy both antiquated and constipated, and an enemy well-established and fanatical. Calvin headed to a well-deserved R&R. Joe was about to embark on another combat control first, this one in a place neither friend knew existed. A mountain cave complex 100 miles east of Kabul on the Pakistan border. A place called Tora Bora. Chapter 6. September 11th, 2001. Combat controller Joe O'Keefe was on his morning 6-mile run around the flight line of Pope Air Force Base when a 2-4 STS four-wheeled mule cargo buggy pulled up beside him. The driver shouted, "You better come back to the squadron, now!" He hopped in and returned to the 2-4 inside the JSOC compound to find the first World Trade Center tower smoking on television. And he knew he was going. Where was difficult to say. Joe, an 18-year veteran CCT, was part of a pilot team of controllers working with Delta Force on advanced force operations, known as AFO. In essence, troops who would arrive before anyone else in sensitive or hostile areas. So wherever he was headed, Joe was guaranteed to be at the farthest edge of America's response. A short time later, he was on his way to Uzbekistan with a fellow AFO team member by the name of Mario. The two men were to be CCT's forwardmost element, chopped to the CIA's Jawbreaker team, responsible for the agency's response to 9/11 in Afghanistan. At a stopover in Germany, they and their Delta counterparts split into separate teams. The first, with Mario, went to Pakistan. Joe and his Delta teammate, a sergeant major named Dan, were joined by a CIA case officer and paramilitary contractor and deployed to Afghanistan as a four-man team, designated Jawbreaker Team Juliet. From Uzbekistan, the men, all wearing indigenous civilian clothing provided by the CIA, caught a flight to Tajikistan, where Joe was introduced to Gary Berntsen, the CIA's lead case officer for Afghanistan and its hunt for Osama bin Laden. The next stop was Kabul, where Calvin Markham and the Triple Nickel were already targeting and destroying Taliban forces. The team flew in a dilapidated Soviet-era Northern Alliance Mi-8 helicopter, skimming just over the Hindu Kush Mountains, already flush with snow on their 20,000-foot peaks. Below him, Joe watched the ghosts and relics of the Soviet invasion slip past the windows. Rusted tank hulks and armored personnel carriers, here and there, artillery pieces and small villages. The steep lunar landscape and abandoned equipment shared an eerie resemblance to the secret test ranges on which he'd trained north of Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada. When they landed at Kabul, which had yet to fall to Calvin Markham and the Green Berets, they staged for their first mission, the rescue of 8 Shelter Now International aid workers, 2 of whom were American. But at the last minute, the rescue was passed to another group. The situation in the capital was fluid and dangerous. As the only CCT attached to the CIA in Kabul, Joe was tasked with landing the first coalition plane at the former Soviet airbase, Bagram Airfield, in support of the agency, even though it was still a no-man's land. He drew on his 18 years of experience to bring in aircraft. "Then I got orders to land an Iranian plane." The Iranian government wanted their embassy up and running as soon as possible to counter the American influence, but refused to participate in multinational actions or assist the Afghans. As he worked his first days at the airfield, much was in motion, but little was known. "There were a lot of things passing in the night," he recalls. At Bagram, Berntsen approached Joe one day and asked, "Can you help me out?" The CIA case officer, and now station chief for the newest CIA base, had 2-foot aviator kit bags stuffed with cash and wanted Joe to manage them. Millions of dollars that the controller dutifully lugged around for weeks, doling out and recording hundreds of thousands of dollars in transactions. "Berntsen was great," he recalls of the legendary case officer. "He had complete faith in us, and we were fully included in all planning and intel, including cable traffic," the CIA's classified communiques. By mid-November, the early gains in Kabul by Markham and the follow-on forces were coming apart as factions and nations staked out turf and foreign policy by force. Joe and Delta Dan helped to establish the CIA's base of operations in a Kabul hotel, where the agency was holding its first captured Arab al-Qaeda fighters. Under interrogation, they revealed bin Laden was at Tora Bora. Joe recalls, "We're trying to figure it out. What's a Tora Bora?" No one had heard of it. Berntsen told Joe's team, "We're pushing forward to the Panjshir Valley, north of Kabul." Before they departed the hotel, Joe met up with Markham. "It was invaluable. Calvin gave me the lay of the land, pointed out details of the Tora Bora region and Jalalabad." A CIA safe house at the latter was their next stop and became the staging base for operations to find bin Laden in Tora Bora. There, Joe met George, the CIA's forward station chief. Also working in the vicinity was a 5th Group ODA with a CCT friend of Joe's, Bill White. The CIA wanted the special forces with Bill to move into Tora Bora and conduct airstrikes to kill or flush out the al-Qaeda leader. At Bagram, Berntsen spoke with 5th Group Commander Colonel Mulholland and requested that he send the ODA and White forward. Mulholland asked if the CIA had detailed information on the situation in Jalalabad. "It's bad," admitted the CIA agent. "Nobody's really in control, and large groups of armed Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters are still creating havoc. Do you have a fixed location where you're going to set up? No, I don't, he said, adding, I'm not prepared to wait for security to improve. I'm going now. Berntsen, knowing any lock on bin Laden would be fleeting, was not going to miss perhaps his only opportunity to kill the terrorist. Mulholland, an experienced Special Forces soldier, was aware how fast things could change. His first two ODAs with Markham and another CCT named Matt Leinhardt were lucky to be alive. Gambling another entire team on the CIA's assessment of an uncontrolled battlefield was not a solid bet in what was shaping up to be a long war, and he declined to commit the ODA. With Mulholland's refusal to commit, the CIA was stuck. Upon receiving the news at the safe house in Jalalabad, George turned to Joe and Delta Dan. Don't you guys do this? He asked. When Joe answered that yes, he could coordinate and call in airstrikes from anywhere, George stated, Okay, be prepared to move out as soon as it gets dark. Joe and Dan exchanged looks, knowing their decision, while fully within their capabilities to execute, had committed them to a mission they knew little about. Joe quickly drew up a fire support plan. I forwarded up the food chain, and just like that, we were in. We four Americans were the first to arrive at Tora Bora. The date was December 3rd. But getting in wasn't just half the challenge, it was almost the fatal half. The four Americans were placed in the back of a covered truck and had cargo stacked on top of them to facilitate being smuggled into enemy territory. Bouncing through the night, they felt the truck stop at a checkpoint. Beyond their claustrophobic confines, an argument broke out between the 10 or so Afghans ferrying them and the unknown checkpoint guards. It occurred to Joe at that moment that their lives were in the hands of CIA-purchased Afghans belonging to a warlord named Babrak. We had AKs, AK-47s, and Afghan garb and hats, but we're, you know, white. If they were discovered, there'd be no doubt the four men were Americans. Luck, however, was on their side, as the situation calmed, and the team felt the truck finally lurch forward and continue on its way, eventually stopping where they unloaded. From there, they proceeded on foot alongside mules packed by their Afghan guides. After walking several miles in the dark, they were introduced to a village chieftain, who was their next link forward, but who was concerned the Americans would bring more of the bombs that had already decimated other villages. I assured him we were there to ensure no bombs hit villages, states Joe. The team told him they needed to move farther, but the chieftain was under orders not to let anything happen to the Americans, not so much for their well-being, but because, as the Afghan currently responsible for their security and moving them forward, Babrak feared that if he lost his Americans, the CIA cash he was receiving would stop. So he refused to take them deeper into the White Mountains, where the locals knew bin Laden and hundreds of Al-Qaeda had established a redoubt. The Americans insisted, however, and continued higher and deeper into the snow-covered slopes. They were deep inside Al-Qaeda's lines, topping 11,000 feet in elevation, but with no idea exactly where the concentrations of enemy forces were, or of bin Laden's location. Joe recalls, We're under-equipped, not prepared to engage anyone. I've got an AK with three magazines. My gear space is taken up with my Soflam, laser rangefinder, and batteries. Though they were all overloaded, like virtually every CCT, Joe was carrying more weight than anyone else on his team. After more punishing miles and some understandable paranoia, they arrived at a suitable observation point facing the highest mountain peaks and got their first good look at the enemy and what they were up against. Joe set up the Soflam and put Dan and one of the CIA agents in charge of turning it on and lasing the targets he'd call in. The other CIA agent, a former Delta Force member, surveyed the enemy positions in front of them and determined their first target, while Joe set out his radios and laser rangefinder, checked the equipment, reviewed his procedures, and made his first call to an AWACS, an airborne battlefield platform expressly designed to coordinate complex air situations. The AWACS aircraft circled above the battle space as Joe told them where he was and that he needed strike aircraft. There was no higher headquarters or clearance for the small team. They'd been empowered, not by the military, but the Central Intelligence Agency, to execute their mission at their own discretion. It may have been a CIA mission, but Joe was now in charge. The AWACS sent his first aircraft, a two-ship formation of F-14s with GBU-10s, laser-guided 2,000-pound bombs. My heart was pounding. I can see the AQ, Al-Qaeda, guys right out in front of us. Joe waited for the planes to arrive, and because the F-14s can self-laze, there was no need for the team to turn on the soft-lam on the first strike. When the Navy fighters reported in, I cleared them hot, and the bomb dropped right in the position. As 2,000 pounds of mixed TNT and aluminum powder, a heat impulse enhancer, tritonal explosive, obliterated an unaware enemy bunker, and the roiling smoke and telltale mushroom of the explosion and its shockwave reverberated throughout the confined valley in front of them, the four men looked at each other and nodded. Joe O'Keefe had just opened the personal war on Osama bin Laden. Within the military, he was known by the acronym UBL. He re-attacked immediately with additional AWACS-provided fighters, and the team, working together with Dan on the soft-lam, cleared the immediate vicinity surrounding their first target, creating a one-kilometer-clear free-fire zone from which they could operate. Their CIA lead agent called back to George, who was working from a location between the team and their safe house in Jalalabad, and reported their intent to bound forward into the air power cleared space. George, himself former military, was elated and told the men, "Great news. Listen, this is being briefed at the White House, and they're really interested in this. I want you to keep moving forward." However, not only were the men and their Afghan guides not armed for a gunfight, they weren't equipped to operate unsupported in the frozen mountains. Of their supplies, Joe recalls, "I had a 1-quart Nalgene water bottle, one MRE, and only a couple spare batteries. We were only supposed to be out for one night. But okay, we're doing it." The men continued their 11,000-foot march through the frigid mountains, aware that each ridge line they crossed could hold dozens, if not hundreds, of Al-Qaeda. Each step was one snowy footfall from death. At their next OP, as they set up their position, Joe had the other men sketch targets and work up the data to support airstrikes while he drew up a terrain map of the mountains and enemy in front of them. They'd managed to take the high ground and were looking down on a hornet's nest of activity. When one of the agency guys passed him a sketch and coordinates to their own location, Joe was confronted with the reality about his situation as the lone CCT. "I realized I couldn't go to bed. I couldn't leave them alone to call strikes unsupervised." It was his responsibility to ensure no friendly fire incidents occurred, and that their own position was safe. Should he fail in this single task, the burden of failure wouldn't rest on any other man's conscience. Joe stayed awake for the next 45 hours, without break, calling every airstrike while the team around him fed him coordinates and battlefield information. Joe and the team didn't know that the first fratricide of the war had just taken place, and an immediate halt to precision JDAM, Joint Direct Attack Munition, the ubiquitous laser-guided bomb, employment, had been directed, with one exception, call sign VB2, Joe O'Keefe. As a result, Every aircraft loaded with weapons in Afghanistan or on its way was now being pushed to the combat controller. It is in this type of situation that a combat controller and all others certified to call airstrikes diverge. Joe explains, I had so many aircraft thrown at me, I started stacking them in 2,000-foot increments using standard non-radar air traffic control procedures. All of them dissimilar. I had B-1s, B-52s, F-16s, F-15s, FA-18 Hornets. It was endless, really. The planes would check in with the AWACS, who forwarded all of them to Joe. As it had with Calvin Markham, and as it would over and over again throughout the new war, it was the expertise of a combat controller that drove the mission's success. The situation was incredibly complex. He had his headset on, listening to the AWACS in one ear and controlling airstrikes and managing an international coalition airport above his head in the other, keying the mics on his two radios, one after the other. His map border and notepads filled up with call signs, aircraft types, and bomb loads. He became the most popular man with every pilot in country. As each plane checked in with the AWACS, Joe could hear them requesting, I want to go to Victor Bravo too, because they knew they'd get to strike right at the heart of Al-Qaeda, even if they weren't aware that Joe was trying to kill bin Laden himself. That's when things really got exciting and exhausting for the controller. He began a non-stop, around-the-clock bombing campaign that went on for days. Without sleep, through the below-freezing nights, without food, Joe bombed Al-Qaeda. 2 days into the onslaught, his agency team leader called back to Burnson and stated, "We're going to shut down now and catch some sleep." The relentless CIA officer, who viewed himself as the long arm of American retribution, was incredulous. What? What the hell do you want to sleep for? You're killing the enemy. Chief, I'm sorry, but we've been doing this for 56 hours straight. Before that, we had to hump up here. We're wiped out. The men had bounded forward four times, deeper into Al-Qaeda-held territory than any American force. Yet they were